Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Life of Gerald Parker. What do you got, Beth?
Gerald Parker was born in 1955 in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh.
He was one of 10 siblings. His mother died giving birth to her 10th child when Jerry was just 8 years old. His father then abandoned the family.
That's really sad. Jerry lived with his grandmother for a few months, and while there, he got in trouble for sniffing glue and was sent to juvenile hall. Afterwards, he and a brother went to live with an older cousin, Florence Russell, in Logan Heights, San Diego.
And she was quite a bit older. She had kids and everything.
Okay. Auntie Florence?
Yes, Auntie Florence. According to Florence, Jerry's mother's death and his father's abandonment, quote, broke up the whole family, destroyed them, unquote. And Jerry was never the same after that. But Florence raised Jerry the best she could, treated him as her own child. And she said that he treated her with respect and kindness.
Jerry went to high school at Boys Republic, a private all-boys school for troubled adolescents located in Chino Hills, California. He did well there and won some awards. However, Jerry later told a psychiatrist that between the ages of 7 and 15, he regularly sniffed glue, paint, and paint thinner, began using marijuana at age 11, used PCP, mushrooms, LSD, and injected speedballs, which is a combo. May I have the speedball combo? Oh, we don't serve that here. This is in and out. Oh, well, it's a combination of heroin and cocaine. Can you get it to me now? Nope, still just a burger joint.
In 1973, at the age of 18, he joined the Marine Corps. And after basic training, he was stationed in Adak, Alaska, where he said that he first tried alcohol. He claimed that he then began drinking every day, including when he was on duty.
I don't think we should be surprised by his continued reaching
use of
for
substances,
things to cope and escape. And there's no intervention anywhere in those, 8-9 years of his life. It makes sense. But Jerry met another Marine named Albert Garcia when they were both stationed in Adak. They became roommates when they were stationed in Tustin, California, from 1974 to 1977. According to Albert, the two partied together on the weekends, drinking alcohol and sometimes smoking marijuana and PCP. I was going to say, wow, that sounds like a fun weekend, but then you add PCP and I'm not interested.
No, thank you. Albert described Jerry as intelligent, quiet, mellow, very respectable, and a model Marine who was promoted to staff sergeant in 5 years. He said he never saw Jerry get into a fight and thought Jerry had good control over his temper. He did not believe Jerry had an alcohol problem, and he had never seen Jerry behave violently after using alcohol or drugs.
Retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Larry Huster, Jerry's commanding officer from 1978 through 1979, while he was a staff sergeant assigned to a heavy transport helicopter squadron in Tustin, later testified at trial regarding Jerry's job performance.
He said that Jerry was the material chief for the squadron, a difficult job, that served a very critical function relating to the flight readiness of the squadron and required exceptional dedication to the task at hand. He received outstanding evaluations from very demanding superiors and had the tremendous honor of being recommended for Warrant Officer's School.
Custer saw Jerry on a weekly basis and thought he was a good Marine. He never knew Jerry to be intoxicated or hungover or to have a drug or alcohol problem. He explained the Marine Corps had a zero-tolerance policy for the use of drugs or alcohol while on duty, especially for aviation units, where lives were on the line, and minimum performance could not be tolerated even in training situations. So how did he do it?
I don't know. I'm really baffled by this story. I don't know if his reporting of the amount of drugs and alcohol he was doing was not true. I don't know. But Custer did not believe it would be possible for someone on drugs or alcohol to perform Jerry's job, as it required an exceptional amount of motivation. But according to Jerry, he drank a case of beer and a half a fifth of vodka every day for a 10 to 11 year period. He also claimed to have suffered 5 head injuries, 3 of which resulted in unconsciousness.
That's a lot. But
yeah,
if you've got your serial killer bingo card ready. Head injury. Yeah,
head injury.
So he claimed that his drinking and drug use reached the point where he was not reporting to work. And by mid-1979, he was about to be kicked out of the military. However, although he was dishonorably discharged in 1980, it was for felony conviction, not for substance abuse.
Parker said he had always had problems meeting women and never developed relationships with them. He never married and never had a girlfriend. And he was a good-looking guy. He was a decent-looking guy.
Yeah.
He later told a psychiatrist that he, quote, always thought of raping women, unquote. So there was something wrong. Something right.
But I, you know, we'll get into it in our takeaways. I mean, that primary relationship with the matriarch or the female in his life who was supposed to, you know, like be there for him.
Right.
Was severed to
the
death.
She was done.
Yeah. So anyway, now let's get into the timeline. So from 1975 to 1978, Parker was stationed at the Marine base in Tustin. His only close friend was Albert Garcia. Between 1978 and 1979, Parker was transferred from Tustin to El Toro, where he spent just a few months. He described his lifestyle at this time as revolving around drinking and using drugs.
According to Parker's later confession, on December 1st, 1978, he was driving around when he parked near an apartment complex near Buena Park, climbed a fence, and went in through the back of the complex. In one apartment, he saw a girl sitting at the table in the kitchen with her back to the living room window. It was 17-year-old Sandra Fry.
Sandra was one of 10 siblings. Her sister Judith described her as very compassionate and loving, the kind of person who would bring home stray animals. Sandra had moved out of the family home just 3 days earlier.
Parker said he went through an open bedroom window, and after watching Sandra for several minutes, he came up behind her and hit her on the head 2 or 3 times with a 2x4. He then dragged her into her bedroom and later on the bed, took off her underwear and his pants, and then ejaculated on her. He then exited through the same window that he had entered.
This is so random, right?
Yeah.
He just pulled over somewhere and noticed somebody sitting in the window.
So I think he was a peeping Tom
and
had been for a long time.
Okay. Thank you, OG of True Crime. So when Sandra's roommate, Georgina Stevenson, returned home that evening, she found Sandra in her bedroom lying unresponsive across the bed and nude from the waist down. Her blouse was pulled up, exposing her bra, and there were obvious signs of trauma to her head.
Paramedics transported her to the hospital, where she was pronounced dead.
Mm.
A pathologist determined that Sandra had died from hemorrhaging caused by cerebral lacerations and skull fractures from an unknown number of blows to her head with a blunt instrument.
Contradicting Parker's claim that Sandra was unaware of his presence before he struck her in the head and rendered her unconscious, there were signs of a struggle in the apartment, and Sandra suffered injuries to her face and neck that were consistent with a struggle. A A latent fingerprint was lifted from the bedroom window that was years later matched to Parker's left index finger.
So this is another thing that is confusing about this story. Parker, in almost every case, says that they were sleeping or he came up behind them or something like that. They didn't know he was there, so there was no struggle.
Yeah.
But clearly there were signs of struggle.
Yeah.
So I don't know why he did that, but yeah, he's lying.
Okay, Beth.
On March 31st, 1979, 21-year-old Kimberly Rollins was alone in a one-bedroom apartment in Costa Mesa that she shared with a roommate named Roberta. Kimberly had just moved out of the apartment she had shared with her sister Cheryl.
Cheryl described Kimberly as her best friend and a very happy and giving person who wanted to have many children. The sisters' plan had been for Kimberly to help Cheryl through her first 2 years of college, and then Cheryl would help Kimberly with her first 2 years of college. That's so sweet.
That's sweet.
Did you and Minnie make any deals like that?
Nope.
Okay.
We should have, but we didn't.
I was just wondering. Okay.
A friend had left her ID at the apartment, and at about 11:30, she came over with her date to retrieve it. The couple spoke with Kimberly for a short time before leaving sometime after midnight. Kimberly asked them to leave the door unlocked on their way out because Roberta didn't have a key to the apartment, and Kimberly was going to go to bed.
According to Parker, he was outside an apartment window listening to three people inside talking. The man and one of the women left, leaving the other woman alone in the apartment. He then drove around for about an hour before coming back.
He entered the apartment through the unlocked front door with the intent to rape the woman. He found the woman sleeping in the bedroom in the nude. Parker said that, and remember, this is all from Parker's point of view.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Parker said that he struck her two or three times with a 2x4 and attempted to rape her. He said he left the apartment the same way he entered and threw the 2x4 onto a garage roof.
Are 2x4s just things people in the 70s had lying around their house?
Well, that's what Parker claims, that they were just lying around everywhere, but I don't think so. I don't know where he got these 2x4s.
These just random 2x4s.
Just laying around everywhere.
Yeah, okay. I wasn't around in the 70s, so I don't know.
I don't remember seeing 2x4s everywhere.
Okay, thanks, Beth. So Kimberly's roommate, Roberta, returned home at about 4:45 a.m. on April 1st. The front door of the apartment was ajar. Hearing what sounded like a heavy sigh or forced breath, Roberta went into the bedroom and found Kimberly unresponsive, wearing only an open bathrobe and lying half on and half off of her bed.
Kimberly's face had been badly beaten. Believing Kimberly to be dead and thinking the person responsible could be inside their apartment, Roberta fled to a neighbor's house to call the police. Kimberly was pronounced dead soon after the paramedics arrived.
That was smart, though, for her to go and call.
Yeah.
In a safe place.
Right.
If you love true crime and you don't want to die. I mean, that's a great tip. So an autopsy showed that Kimberly had died from brain contusions with subdural hematoma as the result of multiple skull fractures from a beating with a blunt object. Semen was found at the scene, which much later in the 90s was matched to Parker's DNA.
On July 19th, 1979, Jane Dee, who was living alone in her Costa Mesa apartment, went to bed between 11 and 11:30 p.m. According to Parker, he had been drinking that night and entered the apartment through an open dining room window.
He found Jane sleeping in the nude and hit her in the head with a 2x4. But according to Jane, she was awakened by noises in the hallway. When she went to investigate, a man grabbed her and told her to shut up, after which she lost consciousness. During the brief encounter, Jane did not notice any signs of his being intoxicated.
Another one where... was he drunk?
Yeah. Or, I mean, if you're drunk, how in the world am I supposed to parkour my ass up through a window? I don't, without hurting myself?
And if somebody's drunk, you smell the alcohol, So the next morning, a friend coming to see Jane found the apartment door open a few inches and Jane lying unconscious in bed on her back. Her eyes were swollen. There were scratches on her face and bruising behind her ear. She looked like, quote, a prize fighter after a fight, unquote.
Mm, that paints the picture.
Yeah.
Jane was taken to the hospital, where she remained in a coma for about 4 weeks, but she survived. However, she had suffered an ear-to-ear skull fracture, and required a permanent tracheostomy as a result of having been strangled.
Wow.
Yeah. And as a result of permanent nerve damage, she had problems chewing and difficulty forming words. DNA extracted from Jane's rape kit was later matched to Parker's profile.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's better, HELP.com/fruit.
Something is creeping. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Clooghless.
On September 14th, 1979, 31-year-old Marilyn Carlton and her 9-year-old son Joseph, then known as Joey, were living in an apartment in Costa Mesa. Joseph described his mother as, quote, "everything a young boy like myself at the time would want in a mother. She cared, protected, guided, put me before herself, and loved me like only a mother could. She was everything to me," unquote.
Parker describes scaling a back wall and entering Marilyn's apartment through an unlocked sliding glass door. Marilyn was asleep in her bed with a nightlight on. Parker hit her in the head 3 or 4 times with the intention of knocking her unconscious so that he could rape her.
Parker said when he exited the bedroom, he bumped into Joey in the dark hallway and the boy asked, quote, "what's wrong with mommy?" unquote. Parker did not say anything, moved the boy aside, and left the apartment the same way he entered.
Joseph later testified how his mother, screaming his name, woke him in the middle of the night. Joseph said he was at her bedroom door when it opened and a dark-skinned man pushed past him, ran down the hallway, and left the apartment.
Inside the bedroom, Joseph turned on the light and found his mother lying on the floor, propped up against her nightstand, incoherent and bleeding. When he realized he could not stop the bleeding, he called the operator.
Mm.
No 911 at that time.
Oh, thank you. But also, I feel so bad for little Joey.
Yeah.
Joey met the police outside saying his mother had been hurt, and he directed the officer to Marilyn's room. Marilyn was found covered with blood with a large wound on top of her skull.
Paramedics transported Marilyn to the hospital where she died the next day from subarachnoid and subdural hemorrhage and cerebral contusions. as a result of blunt force trauma.
Mm. In September of 1979, 20-year-old Diana Green, who was 9 months pregnant, was living in an apartment in Tustin with her husband, Kevin, who was in the Marines. The two were very young when they married and had a somewhat volatile relationship, as a lot of us do in our early relationships, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Too young, really.
Yeah.
To be able to figure out how to work relationships.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah. On the night of September 30th, they had gotten into an argument and Kevin left the apartment in kind of a huff to go get some fast food. He unfortunately did not lock the door behind him when he left. He noticed a black man loitering at the complex, but thought nothing of it.
According to Parker, he was drunk that night and he parked near the Green's apartment complex and started walking around. He heard the argument between Diana and Kevin and saw Kevin leave. Oh my God. Also, isn't it illegal to drive drunk and drink and drive in the 70s? Did we have that yet?
You know, it was, but they weren't so severe about it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just wondering.
Yeah. But I think he didn't care. I mean.
Right. And that's one of my takeaways, because I heard his confession tape or like his police interviews. And he just sounds like somebody who doesn't really care.
Does not give a fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So after waiting a bit and drinking more alcohol, he entered the apartment through the unlocked front door. Diana, who was noticeably pregnant, she was actually 9 months pregnant and 2 weeks
from
her due date.
Oh, yeah. Oh my.
Yeah. So she was about to give birth. And she was lying on the bed in the bedroom. Parker hit her in the head with a board he had picked up outside of the apartment and then raped her.
Oh my God. At 2:15 a.m., a law enforcement officer responded to a call from the apartment and was met outside by Kevin, who appeared to be in a state of shock and said his wife had been injured.
Officers found Diana in the bedroom, unconscious and lying on the bed nude. She was having difficulty breathing and was bleeding from a 2-inch hole in the middle of her forehead, as well as from her ear and nose. There was blood everywhere.
The wound to her head was so deep it exposed brain tissue and was so pronounced, the officer initially believed she had been shot. Diana was transported to the hospital. Initially, an obstetrician was able to detect a fetal heartbeat, but several hours later, her unborn fetus, Chantal, ceased to have vital signs and was delivered stillborn via C-section.
Diana spent 10 days in a coma and remained in the hospital for about 3 weeks. When she regained consciousness, she had total amnesia and could not remember anyone, let alone what had happened to her. She had to learn to talk and spell all over again, a process that took years.
Oh, and then imagine learning that your baby didn't survive. I just can't imagine how difficult that was. Kevin told officers that he was not home at the time of the attack. He said that he had left the apartment, went to Jack in the Box for food, and when he returned, he found his wife had been attacked.
An employee at Jack in the Box told police that Kevin had been there, and police noted at the time that the food in his possession was warm. Kevin also told officers about the black man loitering at the complex.
It's interesting that in this case, the black man didn't go very far, but unfortunately, it is a common excuse in Western society.
Right.
And welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. A black man did it defense is a real thing. And throughout much of American history, it's been one of the most effective ways for a white person who had misbehaved or committed a crime to evade accountability and use a black person as a scapegoat for the actual culprit. But again, I'm pointing it out, but it didn't happen in this case, which is very strange. Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, in this case, police zoned in on Kevin as a suspect when the rape kit came back and the sample taken matched his blood type. There was no DNA testing at the time, and blood typing was one way used to narrow down a suspect. So there's only a few blood types.
A, B, anything else?
Yeah, O positive, O negative, what, A, B, A, B. What?
Just a bunch of letters. Like alphabet soup.
A bunch of letters, but not a lot of blood types. So it's really only a way to narrow down a suspect. You can't use it
to pinpoint.
To pinpoint.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. But also interestingly is that most Black people are O type, positive or negative, including myself. Wow. Hello. And I thought this was interesting because of the DNA and blood. And you know how it gets down. Approximately 45% of Caucasians are type O positive or negative, but 51% of Black people are African-Americans and 57% of Latinx or Hispanic people are type O.
Oh.
Minority and diverse populations therefore play a critical role in meeting the constant need for blood. Call it a culture corner, whatever. I don't know.
I am also type O.
I know. We're the same blood type.
So Kevin's fate was sealed when Diana, quote unquote, remembered that Kevin had attacked her. And you have to remember that she had a major brain injury. And one show I watched, it was Cold Case Files or something like that.
Yeah, I watched that one too.
Mm-hmm. They were talking about how they cautioned the family not to feed her information because she would form a memory around it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
I don't know. I mean, don't know exactly what happened.
Okay.
But she said she recalled Kevin hitting her with his keys.
Okay.
And who knows? Maybe he did at one time hit her with his keys. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe she decided that that's what happened that night.
Okay.
Anyway, neighbors remembered hearing what they thought was the Greens fighting on the night of the attack, which is what happened because they were fighting, and noted that the couple fought often during the course of their short marriage, which was true.
Yeah, Kevin didn't shy away from that.
No, he was like, yep, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. But he did not attack his wife.
Right. So 3 months after the attack, Kevin Green was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon and the murder of his full-term daughter. Diana's brain damage from the trauma was so severe that when the trial went to court a year after the incident, she still had trouble giving a coherent testimony and struggled to spell her own last name for the court record.
But Kevin was convicted of the second-degree murder of Chantel and of assaulting and attempting to murder his wife. He was committed to prison in November of 1980 for a term of 15 years to life.
On October 6th, 1979, 24-year-old Deborah Kennedy was home alone in a Tustin apartment. Late that night, or during the early morning hours, Parker said he took a mallet he found in the back of a pickup truck parked close by and entered Deborah's apartment through a window that was cracked open.
It's interesting how he's going to these places and just finding weapons to use.
Finding weapons, finding, yeah. I mean, finding weapons and finding unlocked doors and windows.
Yeah.
So
I think he's looking for unlocked doors and windows. And I don't know about the weapons, but I have a hard time believing that. And he is finding 2x4s everywhere. And I mean, don't you think he would have brought the weapon with him?
I think so. I mean, I don't know what, I really don't know what to believe. Part of me thinks, okay, so if this was a predominantly Black and brown working class like area, it would make sense if there were like pickup trucks, people who worked in construction, people who worked doing landscaping.
Tools and stuff like that.
Pool work. Yeah, so it makes sense if there would be a lot of pickup trucks and tools and supplies around, but always available to him seems so convenient.
Yeah,
like I can never find a pen. I have to write all the time, but I can never find a pen. And if I had Parker's luck, I would never be out of pens.
There'd be pens everywhere.
Exactly.
So when he entered the living room, he saw Deborah sleep on the floor, leaning against the couch with the television on. She had a blanket over her, but Parker claimed that she was not wearing any clothes, which would be weird, but okay. He hit her on the head with the mallet, then raped her.
When Deborah's sister returned to the apartment the next day at about 6 p.m., the front door was open and Deborah was lying naked in an exaggerated spread eagle position on a blood-soaked mattress on the floor of her bedroom, covered with a knitted shawl.
Deborah was dead. She had massive blunt force trauma to her face and head, and the pathologist who performed the autopsy said her injuries would have required at least 5 blows from a blunt instrument delivered with a large amount of force.
Hmm.
Later testing of the semen swabbed from Deborah's body revealed a DNA profile that matched Parker.
On October 20th, 1979, Deborah Chamberlain and 17-year-old Deborah Senior went together to a party in Fountain Valley, California. Because both are named Deborah, we're going to call Deborah Chamberlain Deborah C and Deborah Senior just Deborah. About 10:30 p.m., Deborah left in Deborah C's car to return home alone to the apartment they shared in Costa Mesa. Deborah C was going to get a ride home from a friend.
According to Parker, that night he pretended to be a jogger in the neighborhood while he looked in windows.
Wow.
Yeah. He saw Deborah's apartment was empty and he entered through a bathroom window. How did he see that her apartment was empty? He was looking through the windows and peeking through every window.
Yeah, the math ain't mathing. So
he's a creeper.
Yeah.
So he'd been hiding, he said, he'd been hiding in the bathroom for about 20 minutes when Deborah came home.
Okay, so when Deborah fell asleep on the couch, Parker exited the bathroom. Oh, he was already in the house.
Yeah.
Exited the bathroom and hit Deborah in the head 2 or 3 times with a 2x4, rendering her unconscious. He then carried her into one of the bedrooms, laid her on the floor, removed her underwear, and raped her.
Deborah C. arrived about 2:30 a.m. and found Deborah lying on the floor of her bedroom near the foot of the bed, unclothed except for a pair of socks. She had suffered severe head trauma and her hair was matted with blood.
A torn blouse and unsnapped bra had been pulled up around her shoulders. Buttons from the blouse were found on the floor next to her body. A green towel had partially been wrapped around her neck. Torn underwear was lying on a pair of shoes near the bed, and the contents of a purse were on the floor near her feet.
So this was kind of a violent attack.
Terrifying.
Deborah died as a result of a hemorrhage from a cerebral laceration and contusions caused by blunt force trauma with skull fractures. Blood spatter at the crime scene was consistent with Deborah's not having moved after being struck on the right side of the head while lying on the bed. So he claimed that he hit her when she was on the couch, but obviously that's not true.
Right, right.
Yeah.
One of the handprints lifted from the windowsill was later matched to Parker's left palm, and later testing of the semen swabbed from Deborah's body revealed a DNA profile that matched Parker's.
On February 2nd, 1980, Parker was visiting his brother in Pasadena when he attacked Aida Demirjian as she was getting out of her car in an underground parking structure. So this is different.
Yeah.
It's outside, not in a home. He hit her 2 or 3 times in the head with an iron rod. She fell down and pretended to be unconscious, but Parker kept hitting her.
The two struggled, but Aida was able to get away and ran for help. She was hospitalized for several days and required surgery and physical therapy to repair a skull fracture and several broken fingers. Shout out to her for surviving. That's amazing.
Yeah. Parker was detained about a block and a half away. He was described as calm, cooperative, and compliant, and did not appear intoxicated when he was detained and taken into custody.
On February 15th, in 1980, less than 2 weeks later, 13-year-old Paula S. attended her father's funeral. At about 3:30 p.m., she was walking home from a store in Tustin where she'd bought her mother a birthday present, and a black van drove past her and pulled over. Parker got out and went around the back of the van as though he were checking the tire.
As Paula walked by the van, he grabbed her by the sweater, punched her in the face, and threw her into the van and drove off.
Oh.
Yeah. While driving, Parker kept looking at Paula through the rearview mirror saying, quote, stay down, or I'll kill you, unquote.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
Also, he is like ramping up as far, you know, this was a terrible thing that he did behind closed doors, but now we're out in the open now, and that's terrifying.
And 2 weeks between these two attacks.
Yeah. So he later stopped in the parking lot of a small shopping center, got into the back of the van and raped this little girl. Afterward, he asked Paula personal questions. What? Such as what her name was and how old she was.
When it was dark, he drove close to where she lived and dropped her off in an alley, threatening to kill her if she told anybody. But when she got home, Paula told her mother immediately what had happened, and the police were called. Paula had noticed that the man had been wearing shiny shoes, and police thought he was probably in the military.
An investigation led to Parker, and when interrogated a few days later, he confessed. Later, he commented that it probably saved the girl's life that she was so young. Fuck out of here. That is disgusting. Where's my shut up?
Shut up!
So on May 13th, 1980, Parker was convicted of kidnapping and rape. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison. And it was this crime that got him dishonorably discharged from the Marines. Wow.
In February of 1984, while Parker was incarcerated at the state prison in Tehachapi, California, for the rape, he attacked his cellmate, David Fuerdedo. While David was sleeping, Parker began hitting him in the back of the head with a curved piece of steel, approximately 2 feet in length. Where do you get something like that in prison?
But why? Parker, why? Oh my God. He just can't like help himself. Oh my God. So David chased Parker out of the room, but presumably it's a cell, and into the hallway, but had to sit down because he was bleeding profusely and almost passed out. The 3 to 4 inch cut on his head required stitches, and he stayed in the hospital facility for a week. Parker did not say why he attacked. Okay, I'm glad somebody asked at least. He didn't say why he attacked David, but later claimed that David was stealing from him.
Okay.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
So now we're going to get into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth!
Parker was in prison in June of 1996 when DNA testing connected him to the 5 murders and to Diana Greene's attack. Law enforcement officers subsequently interrogated him 5 times about these crimes.
Oh, I love it when DNA comes through. I really do. So at first, Parker claimed innocence. I ain't do nothing. And when he was confronted with the fact that his DNA matched the evidence in the crimes, he responded, quote, "I don't know what to tell you," unquote.
I'm sure you don't.
You don't say. So an officer asked Parker if he had ever experienced violent tendencies on PCP or if it was possible he had, quote, "met a girl, saw a girl, followed a girl home, and then whatever happened, happened," unquote.
Parker didn't think he, quote, "could forget something like that," unquote. He continued to deny culpability until later that day when he said it was possible he had killed someone while under the influence of drugs, because sometimes he blacked out and would do and say things he didn't remember.
Interesting. Blame it on the goose. Got you feeling loose. Blame it on Patron. Got you in the zone. Blame it on the alcohol. Blame it on the alcohol. So
that's what he's
doing. That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
So finally that afternoon, Parker confessed to the homicides. He began with Diane Greene's attack, saying, quote, "I believe that there is a man on death row because of something that I did. And out of all these murders and the crimes that I committed over the years, that was the one that bothered me the most," unquote.
When asked, "How many women do you think you attacked?" Parker was not sure. He couldn't recall his first attack, but he did deny attacking any women in other states where he had been stationed. But I wouldn't be surprised if he had.
I wouldn't either, friend. So Parker claimed his intent had been only to knock the women unconscious so he could sexually assault them. He claimed it never occurred to him that he was killing the women because once in a fight, he had knocked his opponent out by hitting him in the head with a 2x4. And this did not kill that man. So,
yeah, so
the
obviously,
logic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it. Can't take me to jail. Bye.
And in June of 1996, Kevin Green, Diana Green's husband, was released from custody after an Orange County Superior Court judge set aside his convictions and dismissed the case against him.
Finally, though. That's a long time. So now we're going to get into the trial. Well, let me tell you what happened. All of Parker's interrogations were audio or video recorded. These recordings were played for the jury, and transcripts of the recordings were provided to the jurors. Parker presented no evidence during the guilt phase and engaged in limited cross-examination of the prosecution's witnesses.
In opening and closing arguments, the defense conceded identity, but relied on Parker's statements to argue he was guilty of only second-degree murder based on diminished capacity due to intoxication. But he was found guilty.
No, really? Oh my gosh. The system, it looks like in this instance, the system did work.
It worked, yeah.
At the penalty phase, the prosecution relied on the facts and circumstances of the murders, including the impact on the victims' families, and introduced evidence regarding the additional acts of violence.
So the attack on Paula and David.
So
and
many
Aida.
Examples. Yeah, unfortunately.
Parker testified on his own behalf, and Albert Garcia also testified on his behalf.
Hmm.
Also presented was the expert opinion of a forensic psychiatrist. Parker had been diagnosed with organic mental syndrome, a psychological issue caused by brain damage, unspecified psychotic disorder, chronic alcohol abuse, and major depression.
However, the prosecution's expert forensic psychiatrist diagnosed him with antisocial personality disorder, or psychopathy, and Parker was sentenced to death. So now let's get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Well, Parker is 68 years old and is currently incarcerated at San Quentin Prison.
Oh.
And he's still on death row, but it's California.
Yeah.
So
he'll be there for a while. Indefinitely, I guess.
Yes.
In October 1999, Governor Gray Davis awarded Kevin Green $620,000 in compensation for the years he spent in prison for a crime he did not commit. He moved to Missouri, where his parents lived, and remarried.
Diana and her parents still held Kevin partially responsible for the attack. Diana claimed that Kevin beat her and left her semi-conscious in the couple's apartment just before Parker entered through an unlocked kitchen door and struck her with a 2x4 and raped her.
Now, I can't remember in the episode, TV show, was Diana ever interviewed? I don't remember seeing her.
No.
Yeah, okay.
Not there.
Okay. So Kevin denies ever striking his wife, but has said he does feel partially responsible because he left her alone in an unlocked apartment.
Diana filed a wrongful death lawsuit shortly after Green's conviction and won a multi-million dollar judgment by default because Green was incarcerated. When he was freed from prison in 1996, Kevin filed a countersuit to have the judgment thrown out.
An Orange County Superior Court judge voided the original judgment, but allowed Diana to file an amended lawsuit. However, he encouraged both sides to settle instead of going to trial. In December of 1999, they settled, finally bringing closure to the two-decade-long legal ordeal for Kevin Green, and also for Diana.
Yeah, although her ordeal is never going to be over.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into what we think made Parker snap and our takes. What do you think, Beth?
Well, a couple of things stuck out to me on this story.
Okay.
I've mentioned them already here and there.
Mm-hmm.
One is that he claimed he was abusing drugs and alcohol, but nobody reported that they saw him intoxicated and he was like doing his job and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So was he really good at hiding it or was he lying? I don't know. But I tend to think he's a liar.
Okay. Say more. Tell me more.
Something else that we didn't really get into was that he often claimed when the women were sleeping that they were sleeping in the nude.
Yes.
But they weren't.
Right.
Their clothes were pulled or torn off of them.
Mm-hmm.
So What the hell is that?
Great question.
Was he trying to say something like they deserved it because they
That's
were sleeping in
thinking.
The nude?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, because back before we as a society knew better, or as a society knew better, that was common. Well, what were you wearing?
Yeah,
and now
true.
Nowadays you would get slapped for saying that for to that, somebody who had yeah. been attacked. But back then, part of me thinks because he was so manipulative,
yeah.
that was
she was sleeping yeah, in she, the nude.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
it feels like yeah. it feels victim blamey, and at the time was probably acceptable. I don't know to say
yeah.
that.
Like the one where the lady fell asleep in front of her couch and he said she was naked, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible,
yeah.
but not likely that
I agree
a woman would do that. Yeah.
I couldn't
it's,
agree
it's
more.
It's just weird.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like I mean, I don't know. I've never been a nudist. I have
yeah.
had nudist friends.
I mean, I
friends.
Know people.
Yeah.
yeah, I know people who like to not wear clothing. So it is possible,
yeah.
but
yeah.
it's not likely.
It does yeah. seem far-fetched, but.
Yes. And the crime scenes often didn't fit his narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Like we talked about, he would say that he attacked these women when they were asleep
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
they didn't know he was there. Mm-hmm. But the evidence suggested there was a struggle.
Yeah.
In any case, it seems to me that he was a habitual liar and very, very angry and violent.
I agree.
Hated women.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the loss of his mother. Early on
yes.
in life.
Yeah.
And even though it wasn't his mom's fault that she died.
No.
I can see in a little boy's mind feeling like she left me.
Yeah. And I will grant that his childhood was sad.
Oh, yeah.
And according to his cousin or his auntie who raised him,
mm-hmm.
his mother was a wonderful mother.
Yeah.
Her loss devastated
mm-hmm.
Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And he experienced a double abandonment from the death of his mother and then when his dad abandoned the family. So there was both of those
yeah,
abandonments.
A lot in a little amount of time for a little person
yeah.
to process. A young person.
And, yeah. you know, I doubt he got any mental health help, given the time period.
The time yeah. period, yeah. And it seems evident, you know, by those diagnoses that were thrown out during the trial that no help was ever administered or rendered to him, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, my thoughts... I felt immediately looking at the time frame that he probably was angry, not just because of what happened in his family, but also I think about what America was like in
yeah.
the late 70s. Like there was...
It was a shitty time for a black man to grow
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and unemployment and poverty and war and displacement and... I don't know if Reagan was in office yet, but...
Not yet,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, it was Jimmy...
1980.
Okay,
yeah.
so... You know, it was a lot. There was a lot to be angry about. And
yeah.
he seemed to me like he was never really able to connect, particularly with people of the opposite sex. You know, he never had
or very many people, period.
In general,
his only
yeah,
friend was,
yeah,
yeah
he only
the
had
one, guy.
One friend.
Yeah.
And I understand why he turned to substances to cope, right? The opposite of addiction is connection. That's what they say in all these like... woo-woo-y get well places.
but did he though? Because obviously he did dabble
yeah,
in
yeah.
some drugs.
But was
and
he
alcohol,
really addicted?
But was and was it as bad as he said?
Yeah, I am not sure. Because again, he said a lot of things I think to minimize
yeah. his crimes.
Actions.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so maybe
and it was also suggested to him.
Yes.
By a police officer.
Yeah.
Well, were you doing drugs?
Doing drugs. Yes. And then he just went with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
yeah. I mean, if the police is suggesting that, you know, it could have been drugs,
yeah,
I'm just going to go
exactly
with it.
What, yeah.
yeah.
That's
totally.
Exactly what
yeah.
happened.
Officer, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. And then, so I understand why he would have been angry. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's unjustified. What is unjustified is
no,
how
what he did
yeah,
with
what
that
he
anger.
Did with that
yeah.
anger. And I just think of so many, I mean, even though mental health wasn't a topic of conversation, especially in the Black community at the time, taking care of ourselves has always been important, right? Our health has always been important. Being well has always been important. So I don't know, I guess I'm disappointed that there was never anything available to him to help him with these issues. because maybe people's lives could have been spared.
Yeah.
And then the husband served so much time for a crime he didn't commit.
Yeah. And it was hard time.
Yeah. Hard time. And according to the Innocence Project, there are like 20,000 wrongfully convicted people in prison at any given time.
Wow.
And
wow.
I'm surprised it took so long for him to get out. And I was sort of struck by the idea that when a white woman is harmed, or lots of white women are harmed, it's almost like, and I'm taking, this is a big swing, a big generalization, but the powers that be devote all of the resources and then some to get the guy and stop white women from being hurt. You know what I mean?
That and the baby.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. White women and white babies.
Yeah.
And so that sort of struck me, because there may have been reasons to investigate the husband, but there wasn't enough reason to convict him.
Yeah.
And that is fucked up. Also, Parker's confession, I did listen to recordings of him speaking. I don't know if it was his confessions or police interviews or whatever, but
just speaking.
Yeah. He sounded very like matter of fact, very clinical, absent of emotion. And it made me wonder if, like, all that loss that he suffered as a young kid, like the lights went out on the part of his being that was capable of connection and empathy.
Yeah.
And all the really human emotions,
like
that
he just shut it off.
Yeah,
back
just
then.
Yeah, yeah, it just turned off. And so,
and which would answer why he was such a good Marine.
Oh my God, I'm done. I'm retired. That's it. This episode's going to the Hall of Fame. We're never recording again. Yeah. Wow. For real.
I mean, they said it was like a kind of a high pressure position he was in, and he got praise for, you know, his work.
Yeah. Whoa, friend. Perfect for the Marines. Also on the serial killer bingo card.
Yeah, the military.
Yeah, yep. Military service and head injuries. Wow.
Yep.
Okay, well, let us know what you think. Beth, where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media.
This is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an evergreen podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.